All right. I am pumped up. That's right. I'm pumped up today. I don't know what the hell's going to happen today. It's going to be wild. We got a whole full show for you, as usual. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Lily Hayden. And Lily's going to be in here talking with us about her brand new album, Lilyland. Can't wait to do that one. All right, really looking forward to that. But opening the show up, we're going to be speaking with someone I've been waiting to speak with for quite some time. I read his book, then read it again, and it's one of these books that actually just will drive you nuts, all right? Because you're reading it and you're thinking, damn, man. Sometimes you just feel like there's so much that you don't know, so much that gets kept hidden from you and actually hidden from the view of everyone, especially if you give a damn about society. You can find it in certain places, and this book is one of those places. The person I'm going to be speaking with is Craig Stephen Wilder. And Craig is a professor of American history at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, and has taught at Dartmouth and Williams College as well. And he's the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And it's just an extremely, extremely powerful book. And as I said, it's a book that lays bare uncomfortable truths about race, slavery, and the American Academy and many of America's revered colleges and universities, from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Rutgers, Williams College, and UNC. Many, many more were soaked in the sweat, the tears, and oftentimes the blood of slaves. The slave economy and higher education grew up together, each nurturing the other, and slavery funded colleges, built campuses, and paid the wages of professors, not to mention a few other things we're going to talk about. So I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Let's start by me telling you again, emphasizing that this book just blew my mind. I mean, it was, you know, I started off and I thought, wow, this is going to be a dense book. Mm-hmm. And it is, and rightfully so. At the same time, there's some points in there that really punch you. And I thought that was something that I really wanted to dig into. And so I was wondering, and we'll start that in a minute, but I was wondering how you came to this book, because the idea of exploring, particularly someone who's currently, you may not come from, but you're currently enmeshed in this whole elite university scene, right?
Right.
And that you come and you're kind of biting the hand that feeds you, right?
Yeah. You are to a certain extent. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, look, I think this started in 2002. It started a long time ago. And I was going, as you mentioned, I was teaching at Williams College. I had just gotten hired at Dartmouth. And I had set out a small project. I just wanted to write an article that was going to explain how it was that black abolitionists, free black people in the Northeast, managed to enter the professions since they couldn't go to college. And it's a New England story. A lot of these kids are coming from as far away as Philadelphia and Baltimore to these New England towns to study with a friendly minister or a school that will accept just a few black students. There's a lot of violence around that. But I became increasingly interested in the question of why they couldn't attend the colleges. In fact, you know, by that time, by the 1830s, for instance, Native Americans had actually been students on campus for almost 200 years. So it wasn't just race that was happening. It actually suggested that colleges had a much bigger role in shaping American society and in determining who was educable and who wasn't, and in shaping the politics of slavery and the politics of conquest. And so I started going back in time. I actually kind of forgot those essays that I was intending to write. And I went way back to the 17th and the 16th century and started looking at the origins of these colleges and the role that they played in the colonial world.
When you did that, and you begin your book by stating straight up that the founding, funding, and development of higher education in America was thoroughly entwined with the social and economic forces that were devastating, transforming, just, you know, causing untold human suffering, untold in the history of the world up to that point in terms of West and Central Africa and what was happening there. Let's explore this a little. You said that human slavery was actually the precondition. It wasn't just something that accompanied, but it was the precondition for the rise of higher education in the Americas.
Yeah. And, you know, let's look at the institutions we know and watch them on the ground. Harvard is established in 1636. It's the first college in the British colonies. There are already colleges in the Spanish colonies. New Spain has colleges. Catholic priests are establishing colleges in the Dominican Republic. What's the Dominican Republic today? Mexico, Peru. The very first college in the Americas is established in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic in 1536, about 100 years before Harvard. When Harvard is established in 1636, the relatively weak Puritan colony of Massachusetts is establishing a college in part to evangelize Native Americans. A major goal of the college is actually to wage sort of cultural warfare against Native people, to convert Native children to Christianity, it's a system of evangelicalism or evangelizing and transformation that would create generational divisions, linguistic and other cultural crises, so that the mechanisms of power and conquest were not just military. They were also educational, they were religious, they were cultural. But to pay for that project, Harvard actually turns increasingly to New England's commercial relationship with the West Indies. As one Harvard historian confesses, Samuel Eliot Morison, in the 20th century, it's the West Indies, it's Barbados that saves New England. New England is a faltering colony until, in fact, it establishes itself as the commercial supplier, the merchant suppliers to the West Indian plantations, where the wealthiest men in the British Atlantic live. And so they begin supplying Barbados and the other British West Indian islands with everything they need, from fish to vegetables to wood to build barrels to carry rum out of those plantations, the cheap fish that's actually used, salted dried fish used to feed enslaved Africans on those plantations. That's how they make their money. And Harvard follows that trade so that the college begins using that commercial network to recruit wealthy students and donors from the West Indies in order to sustain itself and maintain its missions and fund its missions.
And it's amazing because one of the things that you detail, you know, very well is the fact that they actually chased after this. I mean, they, terms of this being sort of, and I want to explore first this economic level that we're on, but in terms of this being the economic foundation of these colleges, and it was a back and forth because on the one hand, they went and they sought out these slave traders and the merchants, you know, who were, you know, nobody wanted to talk about. Well, we're dealing in human flesh, but that was actually what these universities very purposely went out and sought, was the people that had that kind of disposable income, if you will.
Historically, when we mention slavery at all in the context of the university, we tend to actually mention it as if it's just environmental, right? There happened to be slavery in the Atlantic world, and so, of course, there might be a slave or two on the Harvard campus. But in fact, the relationship is much more intentional than that. The universities, the college's trustees and its officers actually sought out the West Indians. They looked for them. They were searching for that money, and they were searching to formalize those relationships. There's an incredible moment that happens right after Harvard is founded. It's founded in 1636. The very next year, the Pequot War breaks out in southern New England and culminates in what's famously known as the Pequot Massacre, the destruction of hundreds of Pequot Indians. Hundreds of women and children are also taken captive, and they're put on a ship named the Desire and sent to the West Indies to be sold as slaves. That ship also returns with Africans. So it's the first slave ship to leave New England, and it's the first slave ship to return. Right after it returns, Harvard gets its first slave. In 1638, only 2 years after the college is founded, a man who's referred to as the Moor is on campus, and he's the slave of basically the headmaster of the school, and he's being used to take care of the rooms, take care of Harvard Yard. And, you know, we have to think about Harvard Yard as a relatively small collection of wood frame buildings. But the slave is there almost from the beginning. And in fact, actually, I think that's a perfect example of what happens across the history of American colleges. The enslaved Africans are always there. They're always on campus, and slave traders are always on the board.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder. And Craig is the author of the book Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. You had another aspect that you spoke about, too, in your book, which actually really got me, too, as you said, the defend and regulate the colonies aspect of the ties that bind. That's what I took as a note, the defend and regulate their colonies aspect of the ties and bind. You called the schools actually imperial instruments akin to armies and forts. What are you talking about there?
What I'm talking about is you really have to look at why Harvard gets established. And, you know, there are multiple reasons. There are multiple historical explanations for the establishment of colonial colleges. I think often we make the argument historically in the historiography that New England needed ministers. It needed well-trained Orthodox ministers. But in fact, actually, by 1636, the Puritan colony is only about 6 or 7 years old when Harvard is founded. It's only about 6 or 7 years old. Most of the people coming are adults. The adults are, in fact, actually the men, are, in fact, include a large number of college graduates, a large number of men who were trained at Cambridge. And so the urgency for a college isn't really that clear in 1636, especially given the other needs of the colony, feeding itself, defending itself, these really quite existential problems that it had. And so I think you have to ask some bigger questions about why it's established at that moment. And I would argue that the British colonialism in the Americas, like Spanish colonialism in the Americas and French colonialism in the Americas, actually operated on a model that had already been rehearsed in Europe. And in much the same way that in the 2 centuries before the first Englishman ever arrives in the Americas, the English crown had already used colleges in its attempts to conquer Ireland and Scotland. It had funded professorships, it had funded colleges, it had tried to wage cultural warfare to help establish religious orthodoxy so that it had other instruments than military power to achieve supremacy in those regions. What you see in the 17th century is the capacity of an emerging English empire to extend that power and extend that model of colonialism across the Atlantic world. And so not only is Harvard established in 1636, but in 1649, just 13 years later, the Parliament approves the New England Company, which is a missionary corporation for the purpose of evangelizing native people. And so when I said that you have to think about colleges like armies and forts, you actually have to think about them as instruments of cultural warfare. And while I know for a lot of people that sounds harsh, that's the role that they're actually playing in the colonial world. You know, there's a brilliant example of it that comes much later in the century, in the early 17th century, in two places, in New England and in Virginia, when they begin actually raising funds in England for the evangelization of Native Americans. And then the Brafferton Fund, the one that's used at the college in William and Mary to establish Brafferton Hall, the Indian college, the instructions actually include taking Native American children from friendly nations and kidnapping Native American children from unfriendly nations to train them up as ministers and then send back people of their own color and blood to evangelize and accelerate the process of cultural transformation. And so I would argue, in fact, that one of the primary roles for us of colleges in the colonial world is precisely that, to be on the front line of a cultural war that's happening between people who are fighting off conquest and the conquerors.
Mm-hmm. That's very heavy. And we'll get back to that towards the end of the discussion, because I think that there's actually some of that that applies as well today when you think about this. Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at MIT and the author of a really fabulous book, a really powerful book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And I have to ask you this, Craig, because it's sort of it's very heavy when when you're talking about this. You're talking about the Native American, the Native peoples here. And throughout your book, there's a constant sort of back and forth in terms of the relationship between the Native peoples and the enslaved African people.
Right, right.
Let's talk about that a little, because it seems to be a linchpin for a lot of what happens.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to do in the book, and I think I had to do it, in some ways, a book about slavery in colleges doesn't make sense until you look closely at Native American history. Or in other words, I asked the question as I was doing the research for this book. It took me 11 years, and there came this moment when I had to try and figure out, why were these tiny little colleges in need of so much money? Or in other words, you know, they were turning to slave traders. They were turning to planters in the South and the West Indies to recruit students for donations, et cetera, to make these close cultural ties and institutional ties. You know, the Puritans in New England are looking to the Puritans in the West Indies for support. The Congregationalists at Yale are looking to Congregationalists in other parts of the Americas. And when the later colleges are established, they do something very similar. Immediately upon their establishment, they start turning to the West Indies and the South for money and students. And I was asking myself, why do these tiny little schools, often some of them actually don't have more than a dozen students, and if they're lucky if they have a single faculty member, why do they need so much money? And part of the answer is actually that they're not just there to educate the kids, the boys who are on campus. They're also there to play this role in the process of conquest and colonialism, this cultural role, this role in accelerating conquest and colonialism.
And you think about this, because you're talking again, I don't know, I mean, it's very happy. It's very,
well, you know,
go ahead.
One of the things that's tied to that is I also didn't want to create this very romantic sense, you know, this sort of romantic history in which Africans, enslaved Africans and Native Americans are both oppressed people, and therefore they can't participate in each other's oppression, because in part of the mechanisms of colonialism actually often put their fates in conflict and mean that the very presence of one group is actually doing damage to the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, and we'll get back to that a little bit as we go along too, because we got a lot to talk about.
Okay.
I'm telling you, I was reading this book and read it again. And I was like, no, damn, man, I should have had you for 2 days up in here, right? Okay, we're talking about slave traders in the backbone of the universities. Yeah. And again, they refer to themselves as merchants. But you also talk about, as you're talking about what's happening between the native peoples and the enslaved African peoples, you're talking about what's happening in society in general. But that actually, it wasn't just the foundation of these schools. Like they needed this, like, yo, where am I going to get the money to start up the school? I got to go. You don't like it, but I got to go do it, right? Well, actually, the whole destiny of these schools, the development of these schools actually coincided with and depended a lot on how the slave trade was doing.
Right.
And it was really very much tied to the peaking of the slave trade represented the full flowering of these universities.
Right. In fact, actually, when I started to make that realization, I think you described it perfectly, that's when the book really came together. It was an 11-year project, and about 6 or 7 years into it, I was still struggling to try to figure out how to bring this story all together. And that became the key. There came a point when I really realized that, and just to describe it, in the British colonies, between 1636 and 1745, there are only three colleges, right? There's Harvard in Massachusetts, 1636. There's William and Mary in Virginia, 1693. And there's Yale College, the collegiate school, in Connecticut, 1701. And so those three colleges actually for, you know, basically 120 years are, in fact, the academic infrastructure of the British colonies. And then between 1745 and 1769, fewer than 25 years, less than a quarter century, seven new colleges get established. Codrington College in Barbados, and all of them fight about who was first, so I'm not going to get into that business, you know, because it's all just ego and foolishness. But Codrington College in Barbados, which we often leave out. We forget that Barbados is part of the British Atlantic world now. So it's Codrington in Barbados, the College of New Jersey, which is now Princeton, the College of Philadelphia, which is now the University of Pennsylvania, King's College, which is now Columbia, Queens College, which is now Rutgers, the College of Rhode Island, which is Brown, and Dartmouth College up in New Hampshire. But that 25-year period, when the number of colleges more than triples, that's when the slave trade is peaking in the Atlantic world. And all of these colleges and all of the denominations, the religious denominations that establish them, are turning to slavery and the slave trade to institutionalize their presences in the American colonies, to make a claim upon the American colonies by establishing churches, schools, colleges, libraries, hospitals, and the money for that institutional transformation is coming directly from the slave trade and slavery.
You know, one of the things that you talk about as well, and you can see that the sort of the impact of all that and how that plays, and you have all these people going into these schools, and there's this idea of like, especially you have a country, you have an area where that is being colonized itself by Britain and various other forces, colonial forces in the world at the time. And you have this population, this settler population, if you will, that comes in and it's training its future generations. And a lot of what happened, I was really moved by the fact that what you have a whole section in the book that talks about how these people were trained in a certain outlook and a certain whole way of looking, and particularly looking at African people. And it happened, too, with the native peoples because they were also called into. You look at all the wars that were fought against the native peoples and how these various collegiate people went out and were the first ones to rush to kill the indigenous people in these wars. But you have this whole thing where a whole dehumanization of particularly the African people, but to a certain extent, as time goes on, the native peoples as well, a dehumanization and the training in the most violent interaction with people that you can imagine.
One of the key elements to telling the story is just being honest about it. And the colleges not only take money from slavery and the slave trade, and they not only have slave traders on their boards of trustees and among their founders, in fact, lots of them. When I started this, I thought the thing that would be difficult to find would be the connections between the trustees and the slave trade. And in fact, it was one of the easiest things because the trustees were often slave traders. So it was an immediate connection. It wasn't something that was sort of, you know, that you had to follow some path to get to. And so not only do they take that money, not only are the students often the sons of slave traders and planters, and the money is coming out of these regions of the world, but you also, in fact, have the active participation of the campuses in many of these sort of wars of empire. And I'll go back to the Pequot War in 1637. Harvard is too young, too immature, and too ephemeral to really participate in that war. But the beginnings of Harvard are really sort of stabilized by that war. When the English, when the Puritans conquer the Pequot, one of the things that happens in the aftermath is they divide up Pequot territory. Remember, they sell all those women and children. They have the massacre. But they also divide up Pequot territory. Well, Harvard gets 2,000 acres of land from that, which becomes part of its endowment and part of what allows it to remain stable. And in fact, it'll acquire land for much of the next century as the Puritans continue to expand into Indian country. By 1675, when King Philip's War breaks out in New England 40 years later, now Harvard is in fact a relatively stable but still small colonial college. It's supplying the colonial government, and Harvard graduates and Harvard students participate in every aspect of King Philip's War. They're everywhere. The children who enter Harvard in the next century are the children of the veterans of the Pequot War. And so universities, colleges, and warfare are in fact tied together fairly early in colonial history. And you're absolutely right. One of the things that's happening on campus is the colleges don't invent the idea that people of color are less than human. That's actually invented in the nasty, miserable business of enslaving people and violently conquering them. But what the colleges do is they refine those ideas and they give them intellectual legitimacy. And that's a key role of the college in shaping the intellectual culture of the Americas that sustains both colonialism and slavery.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me first remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, professor of American history at MIT and the author of a really fabulous book, a really powerful book, Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. Now, I want to move into something that's a little bit different, but it sort of takes us a little further. At that period of time, you had tremendous changes happening in the world. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you had was you had the Enlightenment going on in a certain sense, in science in particular. But you had this irony, and you mention it in the book, you had this irony of all of these people, these universities, these, as we said, the elite universities, the people that are really the sort of the backbone of civilization in the Americas. You have this whole thing where in the midst of all these really important things going on and what could be liberating in a certain sense, mm-hmm. in terms of mental, getting rid of the mental shackles and whatnot, you have all of that. But you also have at the same time the greatest atrocities happening. How did that play out in relation to these universities? Because here they are. They're all, Harvard and Yale and you've got the people with you see all the pictures that are in your book and it's like, wow, these are really, talk about stuffed shirts. These guys really look like it, but at the same time, and everybody's always like, well, you go to Harvard or Yale or Dartmouth or anyway, you're a brainiac, right? And the whole point of you have this enlightenment, you have all the possibility, but you have the most venal things going on in it's a terrible irony there.
Yeah. And I think it's something hard for us to often wrestle with because we want an either or. We want the Enlightenment as a period of sort of intellectual expansion and that tends toward both political and physical liberty. But that's actually inconsistent with some other facts that are just really quite inconvenient but inescapable. The age of the Enlightenment is also the beginning of genocidal warfare. It includes the peak of the Atlantic slave trade and Atlantic slavery. And so you have, in fact, these violent and grotesque contradictions to this sort of this notion of an intellectual culture that's tending toward greater human liberty and greater respect for the individual. And I would argue that it's not really inconsistent, that rooted in the Enlightenment project is also, in fact, underwriting much of the Enlightenment project is conquest, colonialism, and slavery. And so universities aren't just expanding in the Americas at the peak of the slave trade. We have to remember that universities in Europe are also expanding at the peak of the slave trade. The very planters in the West Indies, the William Codrington, who leaves part of his estate to the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in the early 18th century and eventually establishes Codrington College, which I mentioned in Barbados. Codrington also gives to his alma mater, Oxford University. And the British universities, the French universities, the Dutch universities, Spanish universities are actually also benefiting from Atlantic slavery and the slave trade, and they're consuming the products being produced by the Americas. And I don't mean the physical products, the intellectual products, including things like race and racism. They're actually beginning to help in the project of, take over the project of refining those ideas and giving them legitimacy. And so part of the Enlightenment project itself is wrestling with human difference, human variation, but also the vulgar, violent, often grotesque inequalities and brutalities of the world in which the Enlightenment emerges.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind people that you're listening to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder, who's the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled Histories of America's Universities. A really great book, and I really recommend people get this and study it, all right, and think about it a lot because it's just going to open your head up. Craig, before we move into one thing here, I wanted to also ask you this because I always appreciate someone who is fearless in the search for truth, okay?
Thank you.
And in particular, I have to tell you, I loved what you did to Jefferson and Franklin, what they did to themselves, but the fact that you didn't try to cover up what these people were about, because a lot of people might say, well, that was all the stuff was like when England was running the show and this was happening, this was happening. But actually, you had these people who were, in fact, slaveholders themselves, and not only were slaveholders, but actually didn't really apologize for it. They didn't really think there was all that much wrong with it. You know, no matter what the popular mythology is today, let's talk about that a little bit, because I found the one thing about, particularly around Jefferson, about the orangutan question, which was I mean, you know, you read it and you're like, what? Wait a minute, you know?
Yeah. You know, and part of what I wanted to do for readers was to show them how these ideas, how ideas about race and notions of the biological, cultural, and physical inequality of colored people got crafted and then sort of refined in the Atlantic world. And it's an amazing project. When I started this, I actually had thought, a lot of it is in the chapters where I talk about the first medical colleges in the American colonies, the first one being in Philadelphia and the second one in New York. And what I had thought when I went into it was that American students, students from the colonies, were going to Europe to study medicine. And in Europe, they were actually learning about race and coming back. But what I found out when I went to both the American college archives and the European colleges was actually that that's not quite how it worked. The American students in the 1750s, for instance, and 1760s, a lot of young men from the Americas were going to European universities to study medicine. But very often when they emerged on the other side of the Atlantic, they emerged as experts and were treated as experts on race because they had intimate knowledge of Africans and Native Americans. They grew up near Native Americans. They grew up with slaves. They were coming from plantations, and they were the sons of slave traders and planters. They were coming out of the West Indies. They were coming out of Virginia. You know, there were enough Virginians at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland to form a Virginia Club in the 18th century. You know, that's how many of these young wealthy boys there are. And so what you see, actually, when you look at the archives in, for instance, Edinburgh or in London, is you actually see a lot of young American colonial students refining ideas about race and contributing to the race discourse. You know, one of them, William Byrd actually gets the other side of Virginia, gets the other side of the Atlantic and starts giving lectures on what's effectively vitiligo among black people. Another gives a lecture on albinism among Native Americans. But in fact, they're often treated as experts and they're often treated as people who carry extraordinary information. So to come back to Jefferson, Jefferson is actually contributing to this process. Jefferson, in Notes on Virginia, writes that he went out to an Indian mound, a burial site, with his slaves and had them break open graves so that he could collect Indian remains and send to his friends who were researchers in Europe. He also begins to, in that same book, Notes on the State of Virginia, begins to write about and speculate about the biological differences between Africans, Native Americans, and Europeans. And this is where he starts comparing black women to the orangutan, or in fact, what he writes is that the bestiality, effectively, of black people can be proven by the fact that the male orangutan prefers black women to females of its own species. This is an idea that not only attracted Jefferson intellectually, that he liked intellectually, but it's an idea that he'd actually taken from another publication, which was just a few years earlier, the Jamaican planter Edward Long, who did a history of Jamaica, and, you know, included in it a sort of description of the racial civilization of Jamaica as it emerged, uses, in fact, that exact comparison. And Jefferson was a student of and a consumer of the race mythologies of the Atlantic world, which people like Jefferson, who imagined themselves to be intellectuals and part of the intellectual project of the Enlightenment, were refining and popularizing.
All right, Craig, we're going to take a quick station break, give you a chance to recover and think and rest up a little bit, maybe get a drink of water, and then we'll come back and continue the conversation for a little bit.
That sounds great.
Okay,
great. Sounds fantastic.
Liberation is a must. Hey, yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. Welcome back. That's Ross Shiloh with Slavery. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm talking today with Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig is a professor of history, American history at MIT, and he's the author of a really heavy, very important book called Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. And when we left, we were just talking about Jefferson. I have to say, too, you know, Franklin, who is always presented as like the funny old guy that's like, you know, a harebrained genius who, you know, wears his little glasses and loves everybody.
Right.
Actually, was pretty damn didn't like black people a whole lot.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a Franklin we know and there's the Franklin we don't know. And the Franklin we know is the guy who's in Paris, who everybody loves because he's an intellectual and he's relatively secular. And so he fits into the mood of pre-revolutionary Paris quite well. And then there's also the Benjamin Franklin, who is effectively a lifelong slave owner, who opposes slavery at the end of his life, but actually, as one of his biographer notes, never actually emancipates anyone.
Right.
So we talk about him as the founder of the Pennsylvania Abolition Society, but we often fail to mention that all of his slaves either ran away or they died his slaves, or he died and they remained enslaved. And there's also the Franklin, who by the 1750s is deeply enmeshed in the emerging project of defending conquest and colonialism, and who's part of the project. And I don't want to make it sound conspiratorial, because it's not. It's actually the evolution of a body of cultural and intellectual ideas that attend to and respond to conquest, colonialism, and the violent realities of conquest and slavery. But he's part of an intellectual project which is coming to justify slavery and conquest, at least in the extent to which it actually comes to affirm the racial distinctions that allow those trades to be carried on. And so, for instance, the Franklin of the 1750s is part of a generation who are predicting the extinction, if not extermination, of Native people in the Americas. And that's an extraordinary moment. I write about it in the book because I think we all need to remember that in the 18th century, there emerged an extraordinarily dangerous idea, vision of the future of the Americas without, in fact, Native people.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now we have time, I think, for one more question.
Sure.
And I don't know how to actually, I'm going to try and put three or four of them together. Sure. But the point about what you began talking about, American students flocking to Europe, especially going to Scotland, Edinburgh, going to medical school there, learning science. You make in the book, you make this point that says, race did not come from science and theology, but came to science and theology. I wanted you to explain that, because that's the sort of, you got this rise out of that whole time when people were going and they were learning things that were very new and very real in some cases. There was a real progressive aspect to what was going on in Edinburgh. Then you also had the rise of scientific racism when you come back to the States. This is something, a contradiction I wanted to explore a little bit.
Yeah, part of what I wanted readers to remember or to really emphasize was that there's a notion that we often talk about racial science and theological racism as if, in fact, race comes out of those. Those are the vehicles that produce race. And I wanted people to remember that actually it's real people becoming scientists and then imposing upon this emerging body of practices that we call science, racialized beliefs that transform the intellectual culture. And you can see it with the young Americans who are actually in Scotland in the 1760s. You know, they're actually racing. The Philadelphians and the New Yorkers are basically in a competition to see who'll get back first and establish the first medical school, and the Philadelphians win. The Philadelphia is a more logical site for it, actually, because intellectually it's a more sophisticated city, certainly in the 1760s, and more receptive to the Scottish Enlightenment tradition that these kids are studying and these young men are studying it. But they race back. But the thing that I want readers to remember is when they get back to establish those schools, the way that they establish them is by getting access to the corpses and the bodies of enslaved people and Native Americans. And so the Philadelphia Project begins when the colonial government transfers the body of a Negro to the school so they can practice upon him. In New York, the Columbia Medical School, which is the second one in the colonies, rents its laboratories and instruction rooms in New York Hospital, which is situated directly across the street from the Negro's burial ground. And the students raid the burial grounds for the corpses and cadavers. At Dartmouth College, when they established their medical school, one of the first steps to its establishment is the personal physician of the founding president, Eleazar Wheelock. Wheelock shows up to New Hampshire with 8 slaves when he establishes Dartmouth, right? He has more slaves than students. He's got more slaves than faculty. And he's got more slaves than trustees. But his personal physician takes the corpse, the body of a deceased black man, skins it, removes the entire skin from it, boils the body in a pot to separate the flesh from the bone and then wires the bone together for instructional purposes, for a skeleton, for instructional purposes in classes. And then he takes the entire skin and has it tanned like leather. So it can be used for instructional purposes. He actually uses it to dress his instrument case, to basically wrap his instrument case in the flesh of a human being. But that's the brutal, ugly reality of the establishment of medicine in the Americas, and why I argue, in fact, in the book, that the project of establishing science is intertwined with the brutalities of slavery and conquest.
Mm-hmm. And I lied. I have about one question I wanted,
I wanted to
ask you that we only have about a minute to answer
Okay, I'll do it quick.
And this is very important because you talked about when people came back from Europe as well, when they came back from Scotland, that the rise of science, to the extent that science supplanted theology, it eroded the remnants of ecclesiastical control of the academy, but often then brought its own rationalizing of slavery as part of a natural process. That it underwrote the production of knowledge and it distorted the knowable.
Right. Right. That, in fact, actually what you have, certainly by the end of the 18th century and the early 19th century, is you actually start to have a competition between science and theology to see which tradition, which intellectual site is the best site for defending slavery and defending the brutalities of the colonial world. And ultimately, science wins. And I show why in the book, how it comes to win, by in fact asserting that it was the superior position for making provable, reproducible claims about human beings, and so that it supplants what it will describe as the mythologies of theology with the truths of academic science. But those truths are, in fact, truths that ultimately are in defense of slavery and conquest. And because of that, it means that, remember, the very people who are founding the medical schools are the same families, or funding the establishment, are the same families that are the same slave trading families that are establishing the schools. And so their presence distorts what can be known. And you can actually see that process play out on campus as ideas, in fact, get rejected. And in fact, as more humanitarian ideas, ideas about the equality of human beings, which are also rooted in the Enlightenment, get crushed on campus. And this campus becomes a site for actually stopping those conversations.
Mm-hmm. And something that I have to add is that for people who think, oh, well, that was then, this is now, you know what? There's a whole lot of knuckleheads in this country that still, because the impact of this, the way this stuff gets propagated, that still believe a lot of the bull that was propagated by this whole development of the universities and its ties with slavery.
And universities still participate actively in cultures of inequality and injustice.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, Craig, thank you very much for joining us today.
I so appreciate it.
Craig, talk to you again soon, I hope.
I hope so.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, Bill.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Craig Stephen Wilder. Craig is a professor of American history at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's the author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. All right, I thought I'd end this segment of the show by reading a few selections from Bob Avakian's book, Basics. Bob Avakian's the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and these selections have to do with slavery and its relationship to capitalism, back both historically and as it exists today. So check this out. There would be no United States as we know it today without slavery. That is a simple and basic truth. Now, of course, slavery was not the only factor that played a significant part in the emergence of the U.S. as a world power, whose economic strength underlies its massive military force. A major historical factor in all this was the theft of the land on a massive scale from Mexico as well as from native peoples. But, in turn, much of that conquest of land was, for a long period of time up until the Civil War, largely to expand the slave system. Remember the Alamo, we are always reminded. Well, many of the heroes of the Alamo were slave traders and slave chasers, and expanding the slave system was a major aim of the overall war with Mexico, although that war also led to the westward expansion of the developing capitalist system centered in the northern United States. All right, that was from Basics, a book by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Lily Hayden about her brand new CD, Lilyland, so stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back. That's I Am a Man from Lily Hayden, and it's from her new CD, Lilyland. All right. And joining me to talk about all this is Lily Hayden herself.
Hey, Michael. How are you?
Good. I just love seeing that smile. Yeah, I'm so glad to be here. Glad to have you here.
I am so glad to be here. I'm a little teary-eyed after listening to that amazing conversation you just had.
Yeah, very heavy, huh? And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to start with this song, I Am a Man.
I'm so glad you did, because actually when I walked in, having listened to the conversation, I told your colleague over there, please play I Am a Man. It was written for the Civil Rights Museum and inspired by those amazing signs, those iconic signs worn by the sanitation workers when they marched with Martin Luther King before he was killed.
Mm-hmm. And it captures so much. It's sort of when you're listening to the violin come in, you know, you're listening to, there's a certain element of walks you through this, and there's a weightiness to it. But then, and then you listen to the violin when it comes in, and it just takes you someplace else. And you were just saying that you consider this the essence of the CD, yeah?
I do think it's the essence of the CD, because when I was struck by those iconic signs, not only because they distilled down the essence of the civil rights movement, but also because they distilled down the essence of human dignity. And it, to me, that is the crux of every movement, whether it's LGBTQ or whether it's animal rights, even environmental movement, the women's movement. It's all about human dignity. And I am a human being. And 60 years later, I think we can extrapolate and say, okay, I am a man also means I am a human being. I am a being, and I deserve dignity and I deserve respect. And to me, I've always felt that that was the job of music, was to make people feel something in their own hearts so that they could feel other people's hearts.
Yeah, it's extremely important what you're saying there, because I was listening to it last night, and then I came across this statistic. I was reading something in preparation for my first guest that didn't make it, and I hope he hasn't been arrested, or if he was arrested, it was for good reasons. But it's Carl Dix, who's with Cornel West, has called for a month of resistance in October.
Wow.
You know, to mass incarceration, police terror, you know, the criminalization of a generation, just
right.
A man all over the country, people rising up against this.
Wonderful.
Which has a lot to do in terms of when you're thinking about
Definitely.
People's declarations of we are human.
We are human, for sure.
Yeah, and especially when it comes to what's happening with Black and Latino people here. And one of the things that I came across on RevCom.us was a statistic that in 1 month this summer, I think it was between July and August, something like that, there were 59 people killed by the police. You know, you think about this and how that plays in with exactly what you're talking about, the need to declare humanity, and how that has increased even since the 60s and become even more of a question in terms of the actual dehumanizing of a whole section of people.
I think when people are afraid, they aren't able to feel themselves and they're not able to feel other people. And that's when we dehumanize each other. So I think you know, Marvin Gaye said it best, only love can conquer hate. And so that's our job that's what I tried to communicate with this record was a whole lot of love.
You got it. All right, we're talking with Lily Hayden, violinist, vocalist, and composer. That's what it says here.
Thank you.
And actually, all-around good person, and somebody whose music always sets me on my ear, all right? And I meant ear, because it's like I'm glued to whatever it's
going on. Thank you so much.
Let's listen to something that, you know, we've gone from I Am a Man. Let's go to the next cut, which I think is going to take people in a little bit of a different direction. Teddy, let's play track 4, My My, Cross the Line. My, cross the line. Lily Hayden, you crossed the line on that one, man. I didn't want to stop, all right? So tell us about that one.
Well, it's a happy-go-lucky anthem about losing everything and feeling free. The last line that we were fading out on is my favorite. And actually, I co-wrote this song with Marvin Etzioni, wonderful songwriter, and the bass playing is Itai Disraeli. And that line that I wanted to quote is, you never know the price of freedom till you're free. And I had an interesting experience over the last 6 years. Some people know this story. I did a TED talk about it. I had pesticide poisoning, and I got brain damage, and I had to get rid of everything I owned, and I recovered with playing violin. Sight reading classical music again caused neurogenesis and got me to be smart again. Oh, I mean, you know, or something crazy, you know. Anyway,
we just had a conversation about all those elite universities.
Yeah, exactly. It got me to be, you know, myself again. And so this song is about just letting it all go, leave it all behind. It's not going to be the same as it was, but, you know, F it. You know, all right, here we are, and we're going to have a party.
And there's a certain element of, you know, I was thinking about it a little bit differently, which, you know, I got that, but I also thought that there's a certain element when you decide, when you see something is right or wrong, then you got to do it. It doesn't matter what the consequences are, there's a sense of freedom there that comes through in a song as well.
Definitely.
Related to that.
Well, that's true in every case. I mean, whether that's actually, that speaks to the next song that you talked to me you wanted to play, which is actually inspired by a Karl Marx quote, which is, "Here is the rose," and he speaks of times getting so intense, and there's a moment at which you cannot turn away, and you have to face the music. You have to move forward and do, you know, and serve your conscience. And so there is, you know, cross the line. It's basically we grow, we evolve, and these are intense times, as you so articulately describe. And so, yeah, this is about the freedom that comes with the growth.
We're talking with Lily Hayden, violinist, composer, vocalist, and we're talking about her new CD, Lilyland.
It just came out.
Yeah, there you go. And where can people get it, Lily?
Well, thanks for asking. It's on iTunes and Amazon and my website, which is lilyhayden.com.
We're kind of rolling through this, but let me get to the next cut, which I really want people to hear, because I heard it, I think, first when I heard it was the Anita Hill film up in the Sundance.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm also a film composer, and I was lucky enough to score this amazing documentary about Anita Hill. I'm sure everybody in your audience knows. And it's a great documentary. If you haven't seen it, it's also on iTunes. And I wrote this song for the documentary. And it, essentially, times have gotten intense enough, and there's enough violence against women that no longer can we be silent. So in the words of Karl Marx, here's the rose, here's the dance.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to that, Teddy. All right, welcome back. That's Here is the Rose from Lily Hayden's new CD, Lilyland. Lily, let's talk about this one because the Karl Marx quote, but also you said it was your heart in a lot of ways. And one thing that comes through later in the song, which you were just telling me about, is that this was something that was adopted by the 1 Billion Rising.
Yeah, so Eve Ensler basically spoke to the UN statistic that one out of every three women on the planet has been or will be abused or raped in her lifetime, which is basically over a billion people. And so she said all those people and the men who love them should rise up every Valentine's Day, V-Day, and dance. And that would be 1 billion rising, and each year it grows. And so I sent the song to my friend who works with Eve, and Eve wrote me this beautiful letter saying she loved it, and they used that song as part of the, there were a lot of songs written for the campaign, but I was really happy to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what does this song, I mean, you know, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, we got 1 minute. I want to ask you something. Like, if you were to concentrate your feelings when you wrote this, because you wrote it about Anita Hill, but there's so much more. There's so much more concentrated in this, I think. There's what you were talking about 1 Billion Rising, but just the general treatment of women and all this. But there's something more when you talk about the heart involved in this. Can we talk about that a little?
Sure. Well, Anita Hill talks about how violence against women is not really about, you know, sexual harassment is not about sexual harassment. It's power. And so anytime you have any kind, it's basically what you were talking about before, dehumanizing people. And so if you're dehumanizing a woman, you're dehumanizing the creator of life. And so it, honestly, I think while it's important to celebrate our differences, I think the time has come that we really need to just say that we're, you know, one family, obviously, and it's about humanizing each other, and that's why I am a man, actually. Even though this is a very feminist song, and, you know, feminism, all of it, really, it's just humanism. Mm-hmm. So I'm conflating ideas here, but...
No, that's great, that's great. No, I like that. Let me say, we're going to have to make our way out now. We're going to have you back, and we're going to spend a lot of time with you when you come back. We'll just do a whole retrospective of your work, because I really want to explore that.
Thank you so much.
Okay. And I just have to sit still until we get done, because we're going to go out with a special song. One that when you first brought it into this show, the first time you were on this show, we played it and people went crazy over it. We're going to go out with that, and it's How I Got My Brains Back. But before we do that, there's something I want you to hear, and it's Chuck D from Public Enemy reading the pledge for the month of resistance, for the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. Check this out.
No longer will we stand by while millions and millions of people are subjected to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. What kind of society do you want to live in? This October will mark the month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. We refuse to live in a country where police brutality and police murder are daily occurrences. Yet brutal murdering cops are almost never punished for their crimes. Murdering people. Young black and Latino people are treated like criminals, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence. This criminalization has led to 2.2 million people being warehoused in prison, a 500% increase over the past 30 years. Tens of thousands of people in prison are subjected to the torture of long-term solitary confinement. Alongside this has risen a program of criminalizing and incarcerating undocumented immigrants, where the color of a person's skin determines whether they live and how they live. To act to stop these horrors, we pledge to engage in mass determined resistance. No longer will we suffer these abuses in silence or stand by while they are inflicted on others. We will reach out to others and call on them to join us, rallying an increasingly powerful movement of resistance until mass incarceration, police terror, and the criminalization of the youth are no more. This October, we will make good on this pledge in many different ways in every avenue of society. Urge you to join us. What will you do? I'm Chuck D, Public Enemy number one.
All right, that was Chuck D from Public Enemy reading the pledge for the October month of resistance to mass incarceration, police terror, repression, and the criminalization of a generation. If you want to find out more about the October month of resistance, go to stopmassincarceration.net, and you can also go to revcom.us to find out information about the movement for revolution. I want to thank all of my guests today, Stephen Craig Wilder and Lily Hayden. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Teddy Robinson. And I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslade@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslade@redfuture.com. And please feel free to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're going to go out now with How I Got My Brains Back. All right, Lily Hayden, thank you very much for joining us
today.
Thank
you so much, Michael.